90.3 FM Montreal. You're listening to CKUT.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Connor Curtis, Head of Communications with Sierra Club Canada, and today I'm going to be talking with Dr. Louise Comeau, a Senior Advisor at WeClimate, Carleton University's Centre for Climate Change Communications and Public Engagement, and member of the Federal Net Zero Advisory Board. I'm also talking with Rob Barnes, who is the Climate Program Director at the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, CAPE. Rob has over 20 years of nonprofit governance experience, including 15 years of involvement on climate and environmental issues. Rob's work has also focused on executive leadership, engagement, organizing climate-friendly cities, and data-driven communications. We're going to be talking about the carbon tax debate and how it's stifling not only the facts about the policy, but more meaningful debates on climate policies in general. Whether you're for or against carbon pricing, we ask whether it should really be center stage in the media, given its minimal impact on inflation and people's wallets and the massive costs climate change has on Canadians' health and their homes through factors like wildfires and flooding. We also talk about the immediate air pollution carbon pricing helps to minimize, a factor not discussed much in the media, but which causes the deaths of many people in Canada right now. The carbon tax debate and the misinformation spread as part of it has had one effect more than any other effect. It has distracted attention from the oil and gas industry's impact on not just the environment, but on affordability too. Indeed, while carbon pricing doesn't have much of an impact on inflation, for each dollar of inflation in the last 2 years in Canada, 25 cents has gone to oil and gas and mining extraction profits. Before we begin, just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly, on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. ET. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest news from us. Louise, Rob, thank you for joining me today. For those tuning in, do you mind giving a brief description of who you are and what it is that you do?
Shall I start?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my name is Louise Comeau, and I work on climate change policy and climate change communications. I am a senior advisor at WeClimate, which is Carleton University's Center for Climate Change Communications. And I am a recently appointed member of the Federal Net Zero Advisory Body. I'm speaking on behalf of me.
Right.
And I'm Rob Barnes, also speaking on behalf of me, but I'll touch on maybe areas where CAPE and my kind of background overlap. I am the Climate Program Director of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, or CAPE. So I'll often refer to the acronym. It's just easier than saying the whole name of the organization. And I've been active in the environmental space for about 15 years now.
Well, thanks again for joining me. I guess just to jump straight into the topic, right? Everybody's talking right now about carbon tax or carbon pricing, as you know, we often talk about it from a policy perspective. And you know, what is carbon pricing, and you know, does it really cost Canadians? Like what's happening here? Are people really paying a huge price? And is that offset by rebates or is that not offset by rebates?
Well, I think the first thing to say about carbon pricing is let's blame the economists for where we are today. This is the policy that they like. It's said to be efficient because they obviously think through market ideas. And if the price reflects the cost of a product in terms of pollution and other social costs, then that's a good thing. It'll make us do things like not do those things or buy something different or use less of it. And that's the basic idea, is that we're supposed to price pollution and we'll all be rational beings and respond to that price. Unfortunately, getting to that place where the price is deep enough or high enough for us to notice takes some time. And we're at a place where there's more misleading information about a carbon price than there actually is facts. And one of them is that it's costing us a lot of money. And that's simply not the case based on the fact the price is already pretty low right now, but also because we've had a lot of analysis that shows particularly low-income households are getting more money back through the rebate side of the program than they are paying in a carbon price, say at the pumps or when they're paying for home heating.
Yeah, and just to respond to Louise's point, I think it's a great one. I mean, so my academic background, I did some studying in ecological economics, and so I'm not an economist, but I'm guilty of liking the carbon pricing idea because it's so elegant, right? It's so nice and smooth and simple. You know, basically the higher the price, the less people are likely to use it. That said, you know, I think to Louise's point, I mean, I think, you know, people have been starting, you know, over the last few years to really recognize the political risks. And I'm reminded there was actually a, you know, Louise, you'd know more about this than I would, but there was a piece in 2016 by Mark Jacquard, who was actually the professor of my professor when I studied ecological economics. And basically saying, you know, carbon pricing isn't practical on its own. You know, it's one tool in the toolbox, and we should really have a kind of sector specific approach where we're really creating these regulations that target key sectors and reduce emissions there. And to a certain extent, I think, you know, to a certain extent, the government has kind of followed his advice in the sense that we are now seeing, if you look at the political landscape at the federal level, a very sector specific approach. You've got, you know, the zero emissions vehicle policy, the clean electricity policy, the emissions cap policy over here. But, you know, that said, the carbon price remains to a certain extent its flagship climate policy. So there's a tremendous amount from a communications perspective riding on the success of this program, and a political perspective too. The consensus, if I can kind of put a finger on it, is that, you know, the government has not, you know, promoted or effectively communicated this policy. And so now it finds itself in hot water. It's now a political football that it doesn't want to handle.
And it's interesting because you mentioned the emissions cap, right, which is something we've worked on quite a bit, and which is not a carbon tax, despite what people have said about it, or a prosperity cap, or any of the other words that people have put out there about it. It's very specifically going after the industry and its emissions through a type of regulation. It seems like the carbon price, which again is maybe this core policy, has become the center of all discussions on climate policy. And when we talk about it in the media, again, maybe back to inflation, does it actually have that much of an impact on inflation? Because I think that's the number one concern on people's minds right now, right? Like, and it's a concern for me. I think everybody, you know, looks at their bills at the end of the day and it's like, This is a lot, or goes to the grocery store and thinks to themselves afterwards, this is a lot, right? That's a very reasonable thing. First of all, you know, is it actually having that much of an impact on something like inflation? And I guess going on from there, does it actually have, you know, and I know the answer to this to a certain extent, does this actually deserve to be number one story in the media?
Absolutely not. Let's do two things here. One is, we've conflated carbon price to just the consumer price, which is not the story at all. There's an industrial price and a consumer price. The industrial price is doing more of the work in terms of generating emissions reductions, and should be doing even more of the work. In a truly polluter pay system, you would be forcing the carbon price onto large polluters more than you would onto consumers. And that is, in fact, the case, except you'd never guess that by the media coverage and the way the story is being told. The second aspect of it is, let's get rid of the carbon price and we'll eliminate inflation. And that's absurd. The Bank of Canada said that inflation was at 3.8% just last week. That was the current assessment. The governor of the Bank of Canada also said that if we eliminated the carbon price, there would be a one-time benefit of just 0.6%. So less than 1% of the inflation we're dealing with, far less than 1%, just over half a percent, comes from anything to do with a carbon price. The real contribution to inflation is war, It is fuel inflation. It is food inflation. And it is very much not an issue of the carbon price, particularly when you look at the corollary to the consumer price, which is the rebate. And so a part of the challenge, I think, is we as people who do communicate climate change policy have also conflated the carbon price to mean the consumer price. And I think that's created the impression among citizens that somehow climate policy is just for them. And they have a perception that it's not fair as a result. And I think we need to reestablish what fairness looks like, put a lot more pressure, not just on regulating electricity sector and the oil and gas sector and so on, but ensuring that the carbon pricing part that applies to industry is as effective as it can be and gets as many reductions as it should.
Yeah, just thinking about some of Louise's points there. Yeah, certainly that conflation of the consumer facing and the kind of industry facing taxes is really a challenge, right, from a communications perspective. And recently, you know, Connor, I'm reminded there was a recent analysis by the Canadian Climate Institute, which is a great kind of arm's length independent body, does a lot of research on these pieces. And basically the industrial emissions, you know, tax for in their analysis was the best. That is the kind of like that is the real flagship climate policy of the government of Canada leading up to 2030. I need to dig into the analysis a little bit more. I mean, it did find that, you know, consumer facing carbon pricing was important. It's just not, you know, on the kind of scale or order of magnitude of some of these industry facing ones. So I guess in some ways it's hard to kind of hold two narratives at once, right? Like my position would be they're both really important. We should keep, you know, we should do everything we can and more to fight climate change, given the scale, severity of the problem. And then you could go into kind of more, you know, more technical arguments on the social cost of carbon. But, you know, in terms of, you know, where our attention should be focused, you know, there are bigger fish, right, than the consumer facing carbon tax.
And I guess I was listening to Power and Politics today, and I'm listening to like an analysis that you know seemed to indicate that there's some sort of big economic wide impact potentially of this. That they have to acknowledge that there wasn't really an impact on inflation per se, or that you know that have to acknowledge that actually yes, most people are getting back money, more money through this program than they are putting into the price. But this notion that there was some sort of massive economic toll that might be taken in terms of lost productivity or something like that. Immediately, what that said to me is sort of the inverse of what you're saying here about fairness, right? Because often when we talk about that sort of productivity, or you know, there's a loss in profit, or there's a loss in what we're actually talking about are things that benefit sort of people at very high levels, or you know, very high level investors or companies, and don't tend to actually benefit people. So I'm just curious if there's anything you wanted to say on like how does carbon pricing tie into the wider economic future of the country in that sense.
Well, let's start with where this information is coming from in your reference to the Parliamentary Budget Officer and how limited our capabilities are in telling a story about the transition in the economy based on really quirky elements of what an economic model is, right? I've been fighting this fight on economic modeling for more than 30 years. It is just enough to make you want to scream. And I do on a regular basis when I listen to the Parliamentary Budget Officer. And the reason for that is that models, first of all, are an input. They are not truth, right? They are just a contribution to your ability to understand an issue. Second, he assumes, and they do this all the time with these models, they assume perfect equilibrium within the economy. And that any change from perfect equilibrium is a loss. And so what he's done is looked at the carbon price and how theoretically it rolls through, like you can assume certain pass-through costs if industry and so on is facing something, passes through to costs that consumers end up facing, and that relative to there not being any carbon pricing is the cost to the economy. There's no impact of climate change itself in the model. There's very weak capabilities in the model to reflect or represent innovation and surprises and things that we don't know, the way people react to change and get creative and do new things. And so these models are very, very limited. And to argue that they're truth is really the challenge that I think we face. But the fact of the matter is, when you do price something, over time, the whole point of this, and we shouldn't be shy about saying it, is to make the dirty stuff more expensive and the clean stuff cheap. And so this transition is about doing that. And so as oil and gas and coal become more expensive and the signal is to shift away from that, solar, wind, battery storage technologies, all sorts of those innovations are becoming cheaper. And the logical mm-hmm. thing is that they will start to substitute for these essentially primitive burning of stuff that we just really have to get over. It is, you know, we really have to just stop burning stuff. And so, you know, what's frustrating about the parliamentary budget officer, A, the way he communicates, and B, the way it's being used in our public discourse, is that it just completely ignores that reality, that any transition from the status quo could be perceived as a cost. But if we believed that, we'd never change anything.
We never have cars to begin with because we would have stayed with horses.
Right. We're constantly adapting. And so to create this impression among people who are not climate specialists and who are distracted as they should be, they're paying attention to their cost of living issues and day to day. And I got kids and a mortgage and how do I get to work and all those kinds of things. You know, we're adding this burden and taking advantage of their concerns to essentially undermine climate policy at a time where we should be building climate literacy and climate comfort, climate support, to show people how it is a pathway to affordability and security and a good quality of life. And that's really what we're losing in this debate.
Yeah, one of the basic kind of premises here is that, you know, you need to price pollution, right? And that carbon has a cost. And so if you think about, you know, I mentioned the social cost of carbon idea. You know, there are numerous analyses on how much carbon / climate change costs. But I think, Louise, you are getting at some of these points, right? It's very large, the cost, and also it has a whole bunch of things that are really hard to quantify. You know, mental health impacts, the threat multiplier effect in geopolitics. You know, what's the price of the drought that led to the Arab Spring that, you know, kicked off the Syrian civil war? Like there's so many factors to think through, and they're pretty much all bad. You know, if we look at the climate impacts, it's like, you know, slightly better crop yields in some areas. Of course, you know, in a context of, you know, civil unrest and wildfire smoke and extreme heat deaths. So it is hard to quantify, but I think what is often, you know, from my reading, the consensus on items like the social cost of carbon is that we're consistently pricing it too low, and that if we want to kind of claw back and or somehow capture those so-called externalities into the way we price carbon, we're really going to have to kind of be consistent with this. And so when I look at the House debate on carbon pricing, I see it's a House debate on health, and it's a House debate on climate. And on whether we're going to be kind of responsible and put a price on pollution in the first place.
So I mean, definitely, because some people will be listening to this and they may not agree with carbon pricing, right? There's even environmentalists who may say they don't necessarily think it's the first thing, but definitely hearing that if you're worried about cost of living, it shouldn't be item number one on your mind. I'm curious to go from there and to chat about some of the things that you were talking about, Rob. First of all, practically, does this actually do benefit for the environment? Right? Does carbon pricing actually have a benefit in terms of our fighting climate change? Because it's another thing that seems to be a lot of information around and misinformation around the idea that this is essentially useless or that it doesn't have an impact.
Yeah, I'd say for years, people like me and people much more accomplished than me would argue that it should work, right? Based on a very sound theoretical basis. You know, if you think about some of the building blocks, you know, okay, so it's a market price. Well, market pricing tends to work in a market system. This is a sometimes called a Pigouvian tax. It acts as a disincentive. Okay. And you know, the logic, if the price is higher, you'll buy less of a thing. Okay. That seems sound. The link between, of course, pricing carbon and affecting fossil fuels seems quite airtight, you know, and some of the impacts of fossil fuels in the near term, like air pollution too, you can imagine benefits there. In terms of studies of actual carbon taxes, I was just doing some reading before the call, and I noticed that there was an analysis of BC's carbon price, which I think was introduced in 2008, if I'm not mistaken. And they did find that, you know, surprise, surprise, it does work. It reduced in what they were looking at was the air quality benefits And they found that it reduced particulate matter, PM2.5 emissions by 5 to 11% over the period they were looking at. And the sense was that folks were actually switching their mode of transportation at the margin, right? Like not everyone's doing this. Not everyone can do this. Mm-hmm. It really depended on the viability of the public transit network, actually, in this particular context. But people were switching to, you know, electric vehicles or mostly public transit in this case. So in certain cases, it works, especially when you have choices. I think there's an interesting kind of challenge around, you know, what happens when there aren't alternatives for folks to kind of buy, you know, or to use their money towards. And I think that's interesting and needs further study. But yeah, from the one analysis I've read of what has happened, especially in a Canadian context, it did work. And again, the theory is quite sound. But as Louise says, like, be afraid of elegant theories, right? Like the world is messy. And so even though we have great confidence that this one tool is useful, the politics matters, the communications matters a lot, mm-hmm. and the broader policy context matters a lot. And thinking back to this BC study, they found that there was a lot of switching in upper income brackets, people who could, you know, maybe they had better transit access. I don't know. Depends on the neighborhood they were living in. But these are the people opting not to take their cars because of the cost. So there was actually in this one study, a kind of a regressive effect of carbon pricing. All of these things that might be perfect in theory, there's always complexities when they are implemented. And I do look forward to future studies on especially the Canadian carbon price. But based on what I've seen, I'd have full confidence that it would reduce pollution.
I mean, I would just add the federal government it says that it will carbon pricing will contribute up to 30% of the reductions we need to achieve the target. Most of that will come from the industrial side of it, but the carbon price on the consumer side is not insignificant.
Yeah.
Does that mean, however, that it can't be improved? I think it actually can, and I would like to see an opportunity where we can, you know, get a panel of people together to really, you know, provide some insight and comment. For example, every single regulation that the federal government has imposed includes the opportunity to trade credits. Why don't we just move to a national cap and trade system? Like, why can't we have that conversation? BC also restricts the rebates to lower income households. So the higher your income, you don't get a rebate. I like that idea. Push more of the rebate money into the lower income, but also into programs. If you ask people what they would prefer, a rebate or investing in programs to help me get off fossil fuels, they actually prefer the programs.
Mm-hmm.
And then third, and BC has been saying that in polls forever, but it's also consistent nationally now. And then third, Angus Reid just came out with a poll today, and you know, 70% of Canadians think that the carbon price is ineffective. And I do think there's a problem here with a sense of efficacy in the country, right? We don't perceive that we're actually succeeding. And part of this debate, and I think, you know, there's room, I think, for environmental groups to figure out the balance between challenging governments to do more and be stronger, while at the same time building confidence in the country that we're actually getting somewhere. Mm. And so we're not telling people enough about what's working, how it works, you know, congratulating people, you know, encouraging people to help people feel like we actually can change this ship. We can turn it around and we're doing something. And emissions are starting to come down. I mean, not where science says we obviously need to be, but relative to where Canada has been, mm-hmm. it's been heroic what's happened, I think, over the last, you know, 10 years or so. And we need to continue on that path. Well, we're simply not going to do it. If the public perceives that a policy is ineffective, if they perceive that it's unfair, they're not going to support those policies. And so I think there's a lot of communication and engagement that's needed to build confidence, but to increase literacy. We still have a big gap between believing that climate change is real, shockingly, and that, you know, what the linkages are between fossil fuels and extreme weather. So there's work to be done. And the more we spend our time talking about carbon pricing as a consumer price, we've missed 99.5% of the entire story, right? We're not even talking about the thing.
Well, and this is the thing too. Certainly the carbon tax debate, quote unquote, carbon pricing debate, right, has stifled debate. because there's no room anymore for any discussion of how could we improve a policy or what's another way of implementing it. We don't talk in those terms. And certainly in the media, unfortunately, I don't hear that nuance about like bringing on people with maybe a different view, maybe even a view I don't agree with, but a view that, you know, is nuanced, that isn't like yes or no. Like I tend to be a huge fan personally of the emissions cap, right? Because it goes after the largest polluting industry. And that to me inherently is fair, right? And it's something that, you know, I don't even connect that with, and rightfully so, because the impact of it on anything economically is minimal. I don't even connect that with a personal economic cost, right? So there's so many other discussions, as you say, we should be having. I guess I want to take that to shift into talking about the flip side of this, which is the climate change impacts. And I have a figure here from Environmental Defense quotes where they say, for each dollar of inflation in the last 2 years in Canada, 25 cents has gone to oil and gas and mining extraction profits. Pretty clear to me that the oil and gas industry tends to cost Canadians in a number of different ways. One of them is directly through profiteering and inflation. And another one tends to be through climate change impacts. And as you're saying, Rob, too, like there's another aspect to carbon pricing that we don't even talk about, which is air pollution, right? Immediate air pollution from the emissions reduced. I mean, millions of people every year die as a result of air pollution worldwide. So that's a huge toll that we can have an impact on. What are some of the costs of not doing things like carbon pricing or not having climate policies and not having this debate?
Well, maybe we'll start with, well, there are a few things actually, Connor, in the setup and in the previous conversation, just thinking about the debate, right? Like I'd say there's two things to take note of. If you're kind of maybe, you know, an observer of this and you're kind of on the benches and with your popcorn watching the, as we all do, you know, watching question period on CPAC or something, there's a kind of like, I see the debate over carbon pricing as kind of a proxy. It's a proxy fight against climate policy in general. Like, and I do think it could be the thin edge of the wedge, like in the sense that if this domino falls, I could imagine the opponents of carbon pricing are just going to go for the next thing. And the next big shiny thing could be the emissions cap or the clean electricity regs. Like there are a number of different policies that could come next. And there's been a lot of time and effort spent vilifying this one particular set of policies. Again, to Louise's point, it's not just the consumer-facing one. It's more than that. So there's that. And then there's, of course, another argument that often gets trotted out in what's essentially like a climate denial mode is, oh, even if Canada moves really, you know, ambitiously on climate change, you know, we're only responsible for, you know, what is 2% of emissions globally, therefore there's nothing that would satisfy, like in that argument, there's no amount of action. You know, you could imagine a policy that took out 100% of our climate change impacts tomorrow. And people would say, well, it doesn't, you know, why bother, right? Canada's so small. And of course, they ignore the per capita emissions, they ignore historical emissions and all sorts of different other ways of looking at this. So all that is just to kind of set it up. I mean, but to your point around the cost here, and you mentioned air pollution, in terms of the numbers, like 1 in 7 people in Canada die prematurely from fossil fuel related air pollution. So the numbers are big globally and they're big in Canada. And of course, you think about the impacts like wildfires, which we'll likely see again this year. It does make a dent. It makes a dent in the near term and in the long term. And so CAPE has been on the record for a long time being very much pro carbon pricing because of the impacts, the beneficial impacts that pricing carbon and taking action on climate change can do both in the near and the long term. So that's kind of been our position from the start. And I don't think it's changed too much, despite the kind of the ups and downs of the political cycle and the political debate.
I mean, climate change cost the economy last year $3 billion, just extreme events. I don't even think that includes the disaster relief part of it. And so billions and billions of dollars are already hitting the economy in terms of these climate extremes. And that doesn't take into account the psychological impact of these events and what's happening to people day to day. It is the case, though, that while these impacts are growing and people understand that climate change impacts are happening, they are still happening to a very small proportion of the population. And so sadly, we see this big disconnect between people's perception that climate change is real, that extreme events that are happening, and that it will affect them. Hmm. And that distance gap is actually an important psychological barrier to supporting climate policy. And so the storytelling about climate change itself, hearing from people that look like us, you know, that tell stories about their lives, what's happening in their communities, we need to do a lot more of that storytelling to create empathy and to help people understand, oh, that could happen to me. It's like that in this mm-hmm. place too. And really, I think part of the frustration I feel around the carbon pricing debate is that it's keeping us from telling those stories because we're in reactive mode and we're trying to defend things and we're forgetting, I think, perhaps the important need to make this issue, it may feel real to us because we live with it every day, but it's actually not that real to most Canadians. And so making the link between the causes of climate change and the risks of climate change and telling the stories about it, we think maybe that phase is past and we can just have a debate about solutions. But that is part of where we're at, particularly mm-hmm. among the most engaged Canadians, but it's not for a big component of the Canadian population. And so even if we're going to tell a story about carbon pricing, we need to remember we have to explain how climate change works and what's at stake and tell stories about real people.
I guess that ties into something that I wanted to talk about here today, because it's true that, you know, climate impacts in Canada, when we look at them, we saw them on the news last summer with the wildfires, right? We experienced them in cities because we, you know, working around. I mean, I remember in Montreal seeing, like, you couldn't see the sun one day because the smoke was that thick. And that has a huge impact psychologically for me, because I know where that's coming from, and I can see it affecting people around me who I care about, you know, breathing in that smoke. I can see communities in Canada that are often devastated, maybe even destroyed by climate impacts. I mean, Fox Lake, which is a community in northern Alberta, is looking at a huge rebuilding process that's very difficult given the location. That's just one community among so many, especially in the Northwest Territories, for instance, who were hit this past year. And often it seems people who are, when we talk about this issue of fairness, right? It's the people who are receiving more in their rebate from the carbon pricing who are also the people who are costed the most from climate change. So the people who have the kind of least impetus to buy into it sometimes are the people who the carbon pricing costs them a little bit more because they're making a lot more money, and because maybe they have more means to adapt to climate change. They're not worrying so much about it. It seems really unfair to me the way, as you say, this debate has taken away from that. And so I'm curious, this is sort of a bit of an add-on question, in terms of the media debate, in terms of what you're seeing all the way from journalists to commentators to us as communications professionals too, right? Because we don't get this right, I think, often. What should we be doing to improve?
Want to start, Rob? Or...
I was going to say I'm on the call with some communications experts. I'm not one of them. I do my best, but why don't I hand it over?
Well, I mean, I did start to speak to that need for more stories that are grounded in the actual issue of climate change itself. I also think we need more stories about carbon pricing that aren't about the debate, but are actually about facts. People are really hungry. One thing I've been wondering about is, could we actually tell some stories, say that somebody, you know, and maybe we help create a campaign around this, but, you know, let's say April 1st comes and everybody, you know, we try to find a group of people willing to track their expenditures from April to June in that 3-month period, and actually track it. Here's exactly what I spent on fuel. Here's exactly what I spent on natural gas. Here's exactly whatever, like the direct stuff that's easy. And then sit down and look at their rebate and then tell that story, right? People actually just really are hungry for that. The other aspect of it is that I mentioned something called a distance gap. There's also something called the perception gap. The perception gap is that we see this in the polling numbers a lot. I may feel like I'm worried about climate change, But I don't actually think you are worried about climate change. And we have the vast majority of Canadians actually worried about climate change. But when you ask them whether or not you, your friends and neighbors are also concerned about climate change, they report a far lower number than is actually the case.
Yeah.
One of the solutions to that perception gap is actually to get people talking to each other about climate change. The most important thing we can do is to talk about it, because it tells the people we care about that it's important to us. And we have to find spokespeople who are different than ourselves from in terms of environmentalists, because we're not trusted by every segment of the population. And so more tradespeople talking, here's how a heat pump works, you know, here's what you do with that kind of thing. Here's how the story of me on transit or electric vehicle or whatever. And that's what I find. I'm doing focus groups right now. We're doing 13 focus groups. And so I'm listening to Canadians quite a bit right now. And they just are hungry for some facts. They're very confident to say that social media is a cesspool. They feel, yep, they're not getting the full story, but they're not really sure where to turn to get the story in a way that they can trust. Physicians are obviously, you may not know obviously, but when you do the polling, doctors are coming up as among the most trusted scientists and so on. And there is a real hunger for some positivity and some confidence building. And I think that to the degree that environmental groups have power to bring other spokespeople and to give them space, give them the mic, I think that could do very well for us as a way to get stories going and a way to encourage people to talk to each other about climate change.
To your point too, Louise, I mean, the entire premise of CAPE, the organization I work for, is that it's originally it was physician led. Now it's all healthcare providers. But, you know, and as you say, you know, in terms of trusted messengers, physicians tend to do well. Sometimes depending on the poll, when they, you know, separate it out by profession, sometimes nurses are on top, but certainly respected. And I think also there's kind of an assumption that the health frame or leading with the health frame works. And so sometimes when I think about climate change, like my job is climate director at CAPE, I kind of differentiate between the long-term and the near-term impacts, right? So long-term is bad, 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 right? You can go down the list and those of us who care about climate as an issue probably saw, you know, the outlines of why that's bad. In the near-term though, there's a bunch of kind of interesting pieces around, you know, fossil fuel emissions and the co-pollutants that come out of some of the processes, whether it's, you know, natural gas fired electricity generation or if it's driving your car around. And so it often boils down to air quality issues. And as I mentioned, you know, there's some pretty serious health impacts, premature death from air pollution, but then also some of the co-pollutants. And then, you know, it starts sounding like a chemistry test where you go down the list of volatile organic compounds and NOx. But basically, a lot of these things, you know, depending on the analysis, you see there's strong correlations with cancer or asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So certainly talking more about those near-term issues, you know, as Louise, as you mentioned, if there's sometimes a failure to imagine yourself in a similar scenario, but a lot of us know folks who suffer from asthma, a lot of us know folks who have, you know, negative health impacts and I think a lot of us in Canada saw it across the country with the wildfire smoke last year and we'll likely see it again this year. Just knowing, okay, the air quality is really bad, we can't go outside right now. Then all of a sudden it's as real as it's ever been to us, you know, in moments like that. And then thinking kind of more maybe holistically about why air quality matters in general and what we can do to keep the quality high. And it's to stop burning fossil fuels, right? Or to move away, to shift away to cleaner forms of energy.
Yeah. And I would just add mental health, just because it's so important. I just don't want to forget it. And the reason I wanted to mention mental health is that it is a way to bring in rural people. The dynamic in rural Canada is very different than the urban environment where air quality really can make a difference. And in a pulp town, maybe you've got it, like maybe where the oil refinery is, you've maybe got it. But what we see in the rural side of it is that it is a mental health thing, that people need to be in nature, that they have a love for nature, they want to conserve nature, they interact with losing the salmon, losing their fish, right? Yeah. Not being able to go fishing anymore, not being able to tap trees for syrup in the spring, not being able to grow their food. These are things that actually really matter to rural people. And bringing the climate change extreme event impact story to that and how it affects them and their mental health and their physical health from a different perspective is actually a story that needs to be told and a way to, I think, smooth out the rough edges of our polarization through more love stories, really, is really what's lacking in this conversation. Is where, you know, there is love stories to be told and we're just not telling.
I'm curious about that because, yeah, you bring up great points. I mean, first of all, being from a more rural place myself, right? Like I think about that now and going back when I can. And like, yeah, there is a real, when you talk to people in communities who are watching the water come up every single year, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. And, you know, they used to be down on that same beach. So they're out there experiencing it, right? Like we just had a... We just recorded another episode with one of our Wild Child programs at Sierra Club Canada, where the guest I had was talking about in the wake of Hurricane Fiona, right? Children who had grown very attached to this specific tree, needing to go out and find the tree and make sure it was okay, right? These are realities that, you know, particularly if you're from a rural place, you grow up with. And again, back to those health impacts. I mean, we had a situation last year where the air quality was so bad in cities. Our Breathe Easy program with Sierra Club Canada was teaching people how to make budget indoor air filters because not everybody can afford like the pre-made air filter. So here's how you can tape a filter to a fan and make that work. And I think it was Kate as well that came out with a study actually looking at, again, not the carbon pricing, different policy, the emissions cap, but looking at how that could save thousands of lives just from that immediate air pollution from the burning of fossil fuels and that we have in Canada. These are all these like central core things that are super close to people's lives, let alone losing their house to flooding or wildfires or not being able to insure their house because of flooding. Maybe just to end, for those people, this is going to drop just before a long weekend, and a lot of people are going to be having these discussions with their family. Do you have any advice for them in talking to family members about these issues?
Maybe I'll just go back to Louise's point, lead with love. I mean, you know, people notice when your heart's in the right place, and whether you're opposed on an issue, if it's a good faith friendly discussion versus a rancorous debate. I mean, when I heard you say that, Louise, I thought about the fact that, you know, my family is like many of our families, perhaps all of our families across the country, very diverse in the sense of, you know, perspective, and people vote for every party under the sun and they adopt any number of positions. And I might be the token environmentalist at those gatherings, but think of, you love these people, right? They're your family. And so we can have real meaningful conversations. And as Louise said, bringing up the climate change angle is so important, right? Like not being afraid to name it and to talk about it. And they see, I think they see how you engage in the topic. Like you don't need to kind of win. I don't think it's a debate that way. It's a discussion. And basically sharing perspectives, I think, is a really important part of the process. Whether it resolves our political challenges in a day, that remains to be seen. But I do think that, you know, there's sometimes polling, you know, before and after, you know, Thanksgiving or Easter, you know, where families get together. And sometimes it shifts the mood of the country. I've seen some stuff out of the States where, you know, a Thanksgiving, you know, weekend changed the polling in some presidential race. I forget the context. But so these things really do have a measurable impact. And it'd be actually interesting. Maybe, Louise, this is a project for ReClimate. You can do an analysis on Easter conversations and whether they move the needle on things like climate change.
That'd be a great thing to do. So, I mean, again, starting with what we care about is really the key piece of this, right? So, you know, I give this assignment to my students after I give them about 3 weeks of training in what the social psychologists have learned about how we can do this. And I am not the one who's the best person. I learn as best I can every time I have this chat with my son. But talking to him about what I care about and why I'm worried about climate change itself, why I'm worried about climate change for the grandkids that we both care about, and then kind of easing into, well, what should we do about it? Mm-hmm. I think that the challenge is getting people accurate information. And I, as odd as it may sound, the fact that I went and found the Department of Finance tables and showed my son, because he could not believe that we were having this huge argument, in the media and socially about a lousy 3 cent increase. It's just it's 3 cent. He was convinced because of the way it was being reported that there was going to be a 17 cent increase. And so, you know, there is a way, as Catherine Hayhoe so beautifully says it, to help people update their understanding, right? Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't start there. That's for sure. We need to find a calmer place and a calmer way to get into that. The other one that I think we've never really explored is, what do we do with our rebates? Mm. Is there something that we can actually be thinking about deploying those rebates in ways that make us happy in some way? Is it about saving it over the course of a year to contribute to insulation or windows or a more energy efficient fridge, or, you know, something that's useful that actually does the point of a carbon price, which is the ultimate objective is not to pay it.
Right.
There's no other policy like that, right? The point is not to pay it. And so I'm a very fortunate person. I live in a house that's energy efficient. We have a ground source heat pump. We've been fortunate enough to buy an electric vehicle. I don't really have much carbon in my life. We grow most of our own food. And so when I'm seeing the rebate, it's like, okay, well, what could we do to kind of keep that process going? What's the next thing up we could do? And all I can think about is the idea of using my solar rebate to buy my solar panels. I mean, my carbon rebate to buy my solar panels, that kind of thing. And so we've never got into that dreaming about what one could do with that rebate.
Yeah, I think that's the dream. I do just want, very quickly before we go, you touched on the percent increase in cents, and something we didn't get to in this episode. And I'd just love to just clarify what is going on, like, in the next few days with the carbon price, and what are people hearing, and maybe what are they not getting?
So if you calculate the increase of 3.3 cents on gasoline from the current 14 cents, it is 23% increase. And that sounds like a lot. And that's a number that's being torqued to make you think like the end of times are coming. It is just 3.3 cents or whatever the different fuels are. It's about an average of 3 cents. And so it's a small amount. You don't even notice that week to week with the way gasoline prices fly all over the place. I mean, there was a 9 cent increase overnight just last week in Fredericton. Mm. And so it's in the noise, but the challenge now is that anything that happens in the supermarket, anything that happens at the pump, anything that happens on your natural gas bill, which if you live in Ontario, they very kindly show you the carbon price, which makes my son Joe Canada lose his mind because he sees $40 there. You know, makes you think that there's nothing else going on in the world but the carbon price. And that's the point of my inflation. And the sad part is we could kill the carbon price and it would help very little. It would not reduce real inflation really for people. And we'd have spent all the time we should have spent not addressing the core problems that we
have. And people wouldn't get back the rebates as well. So
they wouldn't get the rebates as well. Yeah.
Rob, Louise, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go, a reminder that you can also take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca, or as we talked about in this podcast, by talking to those who know about these issues. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on our homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. The end of our podcast is actually normally also reserved as a Q&A for your environmental questions. So if you have questions on the environment or on carbon pricing, you can write in to us at info@sierraclub.ca, and we will be happy to help answer them on an upcoming episode of the podcast. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. ET. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest episodes from us.
CKUT 90.3
FM.
CKUT.
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 FM
90.3. Yes, you know it. FM.
Hi.
help us spread the word. CKUT is looking for someone to join our team as the chair of the board of directors. Our board of directors reads the fine print, approves the annual budget, engages in community outreach, and keeps CKUT's eye on the bigger picture. The board meets for 2 hours every month, and the chair circulates agendas, keeps meetings organized, and acts as a liaison between the outside world and the board. If you're passionate about the station, this is an opportunity to help lead CKUT into a new era of community media. For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
Les Productions Nuit d'Afrique presents Malian superstar Oumou Sangaré, who has influenced the likes of Beyoncé and Alicia Keys. Oumou Sangaré will perform an exclusive concert at M. Tillus on April 21st, 2024. Tickets and info at festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Experimental electronic meets a modern-day 80s indie pop rock daydream. Adam Ma is no stranger to creating evocative music. His newest album, Year of the Dog, explores themes surrounding navigating long-term relationships, nostalgia baiting, and the music industry's current state, with appearances from Jordan Lawler, Royal, and Riki. Listen to Adam Ma's latest album, Year of the Dog, on your favorite streaming platform today.
This is a lot like musical chairs, except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than a quarter of a million Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Good day. It is Wednesday, April 10th, 2024, and you are listening to If You Got Ears on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your guest host today, Stefan Christophe. I am going to be doing a feature broadcast of music released by an excellent small cassette label called Constellation Tatsu. This label I've really enjoyed for a number of years. They are diverse in their sounds, releasing ambient music that is both filled by organic instruments, electronic music, drone music, more deep on the experimental side, and also artists from around the world. This is obviously a passion project of love for creativity and creative music, and it's beautiful. I really appreciate a lot of what they do, and I wanted to feature some of their recent releases. So I'm going to do that today here on CKUT in Montreal. You can find more info about the Constellation Tatsu project at ctatsu.bandcamp.com. I'm going to be featuring a bunch of tracks from new releases on the label. You will hear from Andy Aquarius, a project called Glow Phase, Randall Fisher and Dexter Story, Tarot Plane, and Ixri. Check out their work. Some of this is totally new music for me. I am a little bit familiar with Andy Aquarius, and I look forward to sharing a concert with him in Berlin at some point this year. This is If You Got Ears, a platform for experimental music on CKUT, People Powered Radio in Montreal. We air Wednesdays every week on the station. So thanks for tuning in. CKUT, of course, is streaming at ckut.ca and live at 90.3 FM. So here is my special feature on Constellation Tatsu. You'll hear music over the next 2 hours. And I will also put this up on my archives, which are at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. All right, Enjoy the trip and take care.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And